Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Our broadcast today is brought to you by Harry's Razors. Great craftsmanship, a better shave value, and shave options that are customized just for you based on how often you shave. Starter sets start at just $15. You can get $5 off your first purchase. Just log on to harrys.com and use the coupon code THINKINGATHEIST. That's HARRYS.com. Just FYI, I've got my feelers out for graphics artists, motion graphics artists specifically, who might be interested in freelancing for The Thinking Atheist, for YouTube videos and the main website. I used to do a lot of video production for The Thinking Atheist, and these days I find myself without enough hours in the day. I mean, I'm just unable to get in there and spend all this time compositing and keyframing and putting together these complex animated pieces. And I miss having them as part of the website and YouTube page. They've always been fun to write and fun to do. But I'm coming to the point now where it's going to have to be collaborative if that's going to continue. The radio show alone and the speaking tour, the travel alone, makes it nearly impossible to stay in the editing room for the time that these videos require. And this may be a great opportunity to play to the gifts of many in our audience. You know, a lot of talented people out there, much more so than I am, who have something to offer. And if you are interested in tossing your name in the hat as a potential freelancer, just send me an email. You can send it to podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. Just put freelance in the subject line. And then a demo, a link, you know, give me something so I can take a look at the style of work that you do and the quality of work that you do. And I'm going to take some of the best ones and start a dialogue about what might be possible. Now, I'm not sure how all this is going to play out, but it's obvious I've come to the point where I'm going to have to duplicate myself to a degree to be able to produce the level of content that I really want to for this audience. Many people have said they miss the videos. And so I'd like to do everything I can to make that possible. I've got plenty of concepts. I just don't have the time to flesh them out. If I can collaborate with talented people who have something to say and are looking for a freelance gig, maybe we can help each other. So send an email with your demo, podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. Put freelance in the subject line and we'll see kind of what happens. We'll see if anything becomes of this. I'll be curious. Scrolling through the social media pages today, am I the only one that's alarmed by all of these Jared Fogle jokes that are going on? The Subway guy, right? Lost all of that weight, and for the last like 15 years was a spokesperson for Subway. And now it turns out he's been having sex with minors and distributing child pornography, cuts a plea deal, going to do prison time. And so everybody's posting all these gags and talks about, hey, now you're going to get a foot long in prison. Ha ha, that kind of thing. Anybody else find those hugely distasteful? Like, in what context does child molestation become funny? I do not get it. And it's frightening when you look at this innocuous-looking face and you see someone who you think, oh, what a nice guy. What a happy ending to his story. The guy who lost all the weight and got picked up by Subway and now he's living the American dream. And behind the scenes, the guy is a predator. I feel horrible for his wife. Imagine her discovering the man she'd been living with for all this time. And now people are posting all these memes with Jared on the front. Ha ha. Isn't this hysterical? I just don't get it. He distributed child pornography. He had thousands upon thousands of photos and images and solicited sex with children. I do not get this. The other big news, of course, the Ashley Madison hack. with how many names were released? Thousands upon thousands of names. It's a dating service based in Canada, marketed to people who are married or committed in some way. Its slogan is, "Life is short, have an affair." They launched in 2001. The site created from two popular female names, Ashley and Madison. And I guess they're really popular. People are hooking up all over. Well, hackers jump in and they get access to private data, names, addresses, fantasies, credit card information. And over the last several weeks have posted this stuff everywhere. So everybody's latching onto the stories about these moral majority types who've been out banging the drum, if you'll pardon the expression, about sexual morality, and it turns out they had secretly had an Ashley Madison account. But there's a dark side to this hack, a much darker side, that Faisal Saeed Al-Muttar brought up on his Facebook page just a few days ago, and I thought it bore mention here. There's something about the release of information for people who live in countries and cultures where adultery carries a death sentence. It can be tempting to poke fun at the Josh Duggars of the world, the people standing on this mountain of sanctimonious moral superiority, and see that, you know what, they're just as full of shit as anybody, if not more so. I mean, I understand that. I understand the sport of it. Easy meat. They're easy targets. But if you're talking about people in, you know, Saudi Arabia who signed up for an Ashley Madison account and that information goes public, now they face potential execution. I hadn't really thought about it in that context until I saw Faisal's post and I realized, oh, wait a minute. This isn't just somebody cheating on somebody else. This now becomes a matter, in some cases, of life and death. And even though you get to see the fallen star of many of those who previously had stood on the Bible to tell the rest of us how to live our lives, is it right that someone goes in and steals private data and then releases it in this way, putting many people not just in danger of losing their relationships, but perhaps their lives? I think these are compelling questions, you know. Ashley Madison just sounds like shoes. Where'd you get your shoes? Oh, Ashley Madison. Oh, they're darling. Yeah, that's what it sounds like. What else is happening? I was mentioned in a blog article recently. Michael Camp had an article called Three Ways That Atheists Are Good for Christianity. I found this title intriguing, so I checked out the blog. To most people, the title seems contradictory. Aren't atheists rebelling against God and leading people astray? For the most part, no. One of our discoveries in our group's research is that most atheists, or their cousins agnostics, which is a misstatement, by the way, are good for people of faith because their honesty keeps us honest. They can help us learn to think for ourselves. Now, I'm going to stop right here and declare that I think this is a defensive posture around belief, as religious belief in the wake of science and reason has to become less literal, less fundamentalist. It has to drift more into kind of a cultural faith, a malleable, moldable faith that fits each individual kind of thing. I think this is a tactic. And so what they do is they grab someone who is an atheist and they say, hey, you know what? We don't have that many differences after all. We can kind of help each other. In fact, we can all live in the same world together kind of deal, right? The article continues, the exceptions seem to be militant atheists like Richard Dawkins, Bill Maher, and Sam Harris, who only appear to be honest up to a point. In my experience, most atheists are sympathetic people, ones like Ayan Hirsi Ali, Seth Andrews, and Greg Brahe. I hope I say that right, B-R-A-H-E. Forgive me if I got it wrong. Regardless, all atheists help us when they expose and reject the irrational, legalistic and abusive side of religion. That's good. Atheists can actually help us focus on what really counts, compassion and love for humankind, and what's good for the world. Three things atheists can teach us, real fast, before we get to the subject at hand. Three things. Number one, how to be brutally and intellectually honest. Two, how to be a pragmatist with a Bible, not a literalist. agnostic Bart Ehrman teaches us how to look at the New Testament as a rational historian. The evidence tells us we shouldn't believe everything we read in our English translations. There are some errors historically, mostly immaterial, but they are there. Small portions have been miscopied. There are mistranslations, some passages easy to misinterpret. But at the end of the day, like we do with other historical documents that inspire us, we find gems within its pages. Sacred text doesn't have to be infallible to contain spiritual truth. Again, you see that shifting, right? The retreat position. Yeah, we believe in the God of the Bible, but, you know, the Bible itself, take it, leave it. There's some goodness in there. Number three, how to put God where he or she belongs. In other words, atheists teach us to take God outside religion and the church, which too often spiritually abuse people. They promote doing good for its own sake. That's humanism, by the way. Far from leading us astray, atheists and agnostics can lead us toward a more reasoned and reasonable faith that makes love for neighbor more important than religion. That's a good thing. I can't tell if this plays into the coexist narrative or what. I like the idea of people keeping each other honest, not living in a bubble, surrounding yourself with competing ideas to see which ones, the best ones, hopefully will win. I get that. I like that. But the idea that non-belief actually helps Christianity refine itself to a more pure form, I think, is a huge stretch. You know what I'm saying? That's a huge stretch. And I think it's a reflection of fundamental faith becoming obsolete in the 21st century. Now people are making their religion in their own image. Oh, look, we can grab the morsels that appeal to us, the gems that are spiritual truths in our own lives, and we can live those truths. I just don't get it. I don't buy it. It's either true or it's not. It's either real or it's not. It's supported by the evidence or it's not. The God-man Jesus lived or he didn't. There's original sin or there isn't. We require salvation or we don't. There's a heaven and hell or there isn't. Period. If we want to cherry pick morsels of philosophical thought or inspirational ideas from books, both contemporary and ancient, there are much, much better books than the Bible. Anyway, I do appreciate the kind word. But I don't align with the message that the blog article is trying to convey, that skepticism by atheists actually helps to streamline and shore up true Christianity. I don't buy that. Just don't buy it at all. Enough of that. Let's talk about what we came here to talk about, which is the butterfly effect. Before I do so, huge thanks to today's show sponsor, Harry's Razors. Harry's asking the question, when did shaving have to get expensive? Do we really have to plunk down big bucks for quote-unquote premium razors when we're actually paying extra so the big-name shaving companies can sell you the big name, right? Harry's was started by a couple guys who just said, hey, we can do this and we can do it better. They're quality blades manufactured in Germany. Their shave plans custom tailored based on how often you shave and free shipping directly to you. That means you're not paying the markup for some middleman somewhere. Starter sets start at $15. That's the razor, three blades, your choice of Harry's shave cream or shave gel. And right now it's $5 off your first purchase at harrys.com if you use the coupon code ThinkingAtheist. I was introduced to Harry's last year. I love them. That's why they're a show sponsor. They're a great shave solution for you, a great gift for somebody you care about, and an organization that's revolutionizing the shaving industry. So check them out, harrys.com, and use that coupon code ThinkingAtheist on your first set to save $5. HARRYS.com. Tara sent an email and said this. It was the morning of my first day of college orientation at a big state school. I was by myself and frantic because I was lost and terrified of missing my placement exams, which would obviously have ruined my life. I finally found the right parking garage and parked at the exact same time as another car. A guy my age got out of this other car and he asked if I was there for orientation. He didn't have a parent with him either, and we were both relieved to find somebody else with whom to navigate the campus. We happened to both be going to a Spanish placement exam, and he offered to carry my bag on the way there. We stayed in touch via text throughout the orientation, as well as the rest of the summer he lived in the next state. And when we arrived back on campus to start out our freshman year, we began hanging out daily. I had a roommate with whom I didn't really get along, so I basically spent all my free time over in his dorm. Now, at this point, you're probably thinking that we fell in love, but in fact, he is gay, and thus we were just great friends. However, there was a guy who lived across the hall from him who also didn't get along well with his roommate, so he was always across the hall hanging out with us. Over the next year, the guy, the one across the hall from my orientation friend, and I developed feelings for each other. We turned out to be basically soulmates, if you believe in those. We've now been together 5 years. We graduated from that big state school together a couple years ago, and we're getting married in a secular ceremony next summer. The way I see it, arriving in that parking structure at the same time as my friend completely changed the entire trajectory of my life, and I wouldn't even realize it until much, much later. What is the butterfly effect? The butterfly effect is a term used in chaos theory to describe how small changes to a seemingly unrelated thing or condition, known as the initial condition, can affect large complex systems. The term comes from the suggestion that the flapping of a butterfly's wings in South America could affect the weather in Texas, meaning the tiniest influence on one part of a system can have a huge effect on another part. Taken more broadly, the butterfly effect is a way of describing how, unless all factors can be accounted for, large systems like the weather remain impossible to predict with total accuracy because there are too many unknown variables to track. Jeremiah sent me an email and said, "I know this isn't really what the show's about, but it would be interesting to know. A lot of people really don't understand chaos theory. I've had some experience and taken a class in it as an engineer. People have a perception that chaos is a synonym for randomness and is completely unpredictable. In a sense, chaotic systems are predictable. Lots of chaotic systems are governed by simple Newtonian mechanics. What makes them chaotic is over time their states diverge greatly depending on initial conditions. Your show's topic is far more unpredictable. Not that I'm criticizing. Until we know more about neuroscience, we'll never be able to predict how people behave and what might cause someone's brain to decide to help a random stranger on the road that ends up changing their life because they eventually marry that person." Well, Jeremiah, I will confess to sort of borrowing the term the butterfly effect and bending it a little bit to suit my own purposes, which is to tell some interesting stories about how people act and interact in these quote-unquote random moments and encounters that changed everything for them and perhaps for someone else. But I think it is important for us to take a few seconds here and kind of define more properly what chaos theory is and how the butterfly effect plays into that. So at least we know the rule before we break it. And I knew Dr. Jerry Coyne had a perspective on this. He is an evolutionary biologist. He's an author. He's been on the show many times. And we've talked on different occasions about chaos theory. We've talked about determinism, randomness, those types of things. And I thought he might have something to contribute to the broadcast today. And so I've invited him to stop by. Jerry, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So I know you've got a perspective on chaos theory. The challenge I have as a host, Jerry, is that I want to address the science of it without melting everybody's brain or boring them to tears or overwhelming them with data. So to take this very complex concept and to make it palatable for the audience and for myself is a little bit of a challenge. So give me kind of a primer. From your perspective, what are we talking about when we talk about chaos and chaos theory?
It's a theory now, originally started as an observation back in the 70s, of a computer model of the weather where a guy showed that you could have nice predictability from the weather. And then he went back and he changed some of the parameters just a teeny bit, like taking something that he knew to 6 decimal places. like, you know, the temperature down to 3 decimal places only, which means we don't know it to the same degree of precision that we knew before. And he found out that the models completely changed, that things went nuts, and the predictability completely depended on an accurate knowledge of the starting conditions. So that's what chaos theory is all about. It's a theory which you can show mathematically or on computers that if you have a very complex system, usually involving the interactions of several different types of factors, and they usually behave in a sort of a cyclical or repetitive way. If you alter the initial conditions, the starting conditions, by just a teeny bit, which in his case, the weather guy was a rounding error, then you can get completely different dynamics of the system. In other words, the predictability of something, and that occurs in economics, it occurs in weather, it occurs in biology with population growth, predator-prey interactions. Our ability to understand what's going on in nature is completely reliant in such systems, not in every system, completely reliant on knowing the initial conditions very, very precisely. And if they change a little bit, then all bets are off. So it depends on our ability to know the beginning of a complex system with almost complete accuracy. That's why it's called the butterfly effect, because of the original observation that if a butterfly flaps its wings in a different way in Brazil, that could affect the weather in Florida or Mexico, which is conceivable because it changes the air currents in a slight manner. That could change the whole, and that could ramify up through chaos theory to change the whole weather pattern. So, you know, there's an interesting science fiction story about this, too, about a guy who has to go back to the past, and he is constrained to stay on a track because this is a commercial operation, so he can look at dinosaurs and stuff. He accidentally steps off the track and squashes a butterfly. When he comes back to the future where he lives, everything is completely different, or slightly different. The words are spelled differently. You know, everything's off a little bit. That's an example of sort of chaos theory ramifying through generation after generation. And that's conceivable, too. It was a very clever story.
So I'm sort of cheating a little bit as I make this an anecdotal show and have people talk about how these random encounters at the beginning of the whatever story they happen to be telling sort of propel them in a different direction.
Well, it's sort of related, but, you know, a person's one-time interaction with another person is not really an example of the kind of thing that chaos theory applies to, which are complex, evolving, interacting systems. I mean, those encounters between, say, John meets Mary at a bar and they wind up having kids and their whole lives are changed, that is purely deterministic, although it may be based on small changes in the molecules of the brain that we don't know about. But that's not really something that a mathematician or biologist would say is an example of chaos theory. That's an example of something that may have been affected by small things in the brain or in the environment that we don't know of, but it's not a complex, dynamical, evolving system like the weather or predator-prey interactions.
By the way, Jerry, author of a new book called Faith Versus Fact, Why Science and Religion Are Incompatible. I see the book's getting out there making waves. How's it doing?
Pretty good. It's, you know, not number one on the bestseller list, and the religionists are going after it, of course, but, you know, I'm happy with it. It's as good a job as I could have done, and the people who seem rational have responded well to it. So I guess that's my definition of rationality.
Yeah, you're not going to convince William Lane Craig. That's a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, the responses are absolutely predictable by religionists. Anybody that's a believer is a critic of that book, and so that gives me some solace because I know it struck a nerve. So,
yeah. Well, congratulations on the book. All my best wishes. Thanks for weighing in on the broadcast today. Much appreciated.
Sure, my pleasure.
Renee sent me a message and said this. She said, I had a birth defect test, open neural tube, come back positive when I was pregnant with my daughter in 2012. We were devastated, but went to a specialist for confirmation and the next steps. When we got to our appointment, the specialist told us that the labs tested me as diabetic, and I'm not. So I was actually not positive for the defect. He wanted to do an ultrasound just to be sure, and that's when we found out my cervix was incompetent. It led to a nightmare of meds and strict bed rest for 2.5 months, and my daughter was born at 35 weeks on the dot. But if that initial test hadn't been done incorrectly, we may have been too late to find out, and she may have come at 24 weeks instead, with a tiny chance of survival. So it's a wonderful little error that in turn ended up providing us with a better chance. I don't believe in a deity or that the universe had a hand in it, because to me, they would have had to have a hand in creating my problem in the first place, and that's just redundant. Chaos, however, can yield unexpected results. Yuri said this, "It was around a year ago when a small protest was winding down in the center of my city. It was nighttime, and the protesters were ready to go home as it was going nowhere. The protest was about some EU association deal, and they were mad that the president refused to sign it, which would have led to closer ties with Europe. However, just as the protesters were beginning to leave, they were brutally broken up by riot police. No one died or anything like that. But the next day, this small demonstration, which would have evaporated without that incident, got a real boost because of it, and now the entire independent square was flooded with people. More and more kept coming. Politicians and businesses joined in soon after. Soon forts and tents began to appear. It was now winter, and people used the abundant snow to put it in cement bags and build large walls around the square, complete with tires, wood, and anything else they could find. The entire place now looked like Lord of the Rings, with a large sea of people encased in a sort of fortress, dwarfing anything similar like a football match. This was on a much grander scale. The riot police attempted several times to break it up, but all failed. And then one day they decided to use bullets. Real bullets. Around 100 people died. This was the tipping point. The president was forced to flee the country, and soon the opposition, which was now leading the protest, took over. But this was just the start. Soon the country began to divide, and war broke out. Planes were shot down, including a civilian plane, where around 400 people died. The casualties were mounting. This was taking its toll, and the company I work for opened a branch in a neighboring country, which is now where I'm at, all because one night some police officers made a bad decision and were too heavy-handed with a few protesters. My country is Ukraine. Yuri, thanks so much for sharing your story. Area code 203, you're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. Who's this?
This is Kaya.
Kaya, we're talking about the butterfly effect on the broadcast today. You have a story for us?
Yeah, I was taking a medical assistant course, and I openly criticized the nursing program director's online portion of the course, which was not wise, but I went and did it. Of course I went and did it. So she formed a grudge against me, and she ended up kicking me out of the course just at the externship, just as we were about to graduate.
There was something about the curriculum that you disagreed with, and so you took it public?
Yeah, it was incompetent, basically. It was an online course. It was a short online course, and I pointed out where it was kind of incompetent.
All right, so you called your instructor essentially incompetent, and your instructor ended up kicking you out of the course. All right, I'm there.
Yeah, pretty much. Yep.
All right. What else?
Yep. And so because of that, I had already been putting my career as a CNA on hold to have time for the course, and I put the course on a credit card, $8,500, and because I wasn't having work, I was banking on graduating the course and getting a job, which now wasn't going to happen. So I took what money I had. The rent was coming up, another lease, so I had to sign another lease, and that was coming up, and I said, this isn't going to happen. So I took what money I had and put it into a storage unit and a membership at the local fitness club, and got an address, mailing address, and urban camped for about 4 months.
Now, when you say you were urban camping, what does that mean?
That means living in your van.
So you didn't have a home. Your vehicle became your home.
Yep.
And wherever you parked, you slept, and every day your home was in a different place kind of thing, or what?
Yeah.
So essentially the medical course doesn't work out, and you then pinball away from graduating, and you're living in your vehicle, and then what happens?
So I was hanging out at McDonald's at all hours because I was unemployed and I was just in a state of shock pretty much. And I met these guys, father and son, and they said, here, give a ride to this guy. He needs a ride to this other town to get his stuff. So I said, okay. And so I gave him a ride and we got to talking, and he was also homeless, but he had just come back from California and had nothing, nobody and nothing. He was sleeping on the floor of a bathroom at a gas station. And I'm like, oh my God, you know. And he was, seemed like a nice guy, and these other guys knew him. So I took a chance. I let him stay in the van that night, you know, in the front. And one thing led to another. We talked and we got to know each other, and we solved our homelessness problem by getting a place together, and we got married. And we've been together 4 years now.
You married the guy who slept in the front seat of your van?
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
I got stuck on something, Kaya. Can I ask you about it?
Absolutely.
So you had no job. You hadn't finished the education because they kicked you out.
Right.
You were living in your van.
Right.
But you bought a fitness membership?
It's a $10 a month thing from Planet Fitness.
Just to get you out of the van to have a place to go kind of thing?
No, to get showers.
Oh, my God. You didn't have a place to clean up, so you bought a fitness membership so you could access their locker areas and their sinks, bathrooms, and showers.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah.
So it's amazing to watch this series of events unfold, and you look at your life now. A few years ago, would you have seen yourself as married and in this particular moment and point in your life?
No, not at all. Not whatsoever.
You doing all right?
Awesome. I am very, very happy with my guy, you know, and my life. Absolutely.
Well, Kaya, thanks for sharing your story on the broadcast today. I wish you and your new hubby a long and happy life together, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Small changes, tiny actions, supposedly nothing, but when they happen, they can change everything. It was the 2nd of October, 1996. Aero Peru Flight 603 was preparing for its flight out of Lima, Peru to Santiago, Chile. It was a Boeing 757, 61 passengers, 9 crew. This was the final leg out of a flight which had originated in Miami about 1 o'clock in the morning. And the conversation from the cockpit to the tower began. Lima Tower, Aero Peru 603, runway 15, ready for takeoff. Flaps 1-5. Increase power. 80 knots. Rotate. Airborne. Gear up. Something's not right. Flight instruments all over the place. Nothing looks right. Nothing matches up. Emergency messages start piling up from the onboard computer. Rudder ratio, Mach speed, trim, overspeed, underspeed, low altitude warnings. Holy shit, what's going on here? No basic instruments, no altimeter, no speedometer, nothing. We declare an emergency. They were over the water. No visual reference whatsoever. How high are we? What's our altitude? What's the airspeed? What's our vertical speed? Right? The only thing they could do is try to turn around and get back to the airport, get back on the ground somehow, get some answers. The crew continued to have dialogue with the tower, just asking for basic information. The co-pilot declared that the speed read zero, all speed zero. So they asked the tower, do you have our speed? If you have us on the radar, can you tell us how fast we're going? It's like each instrument had been willing itself to conflict with the instrument right next to it on the console. It's an avalanche of conflicting data, or no data at all. And propelling in who knows what direction in the darkness, Flight 603 was attempting to get its bearings, to know where it was, where it's going, how fast, how slow, for how long. And then the airplane stalled. Holy shit. Not enough airspeed. Not enough lift. We're not going fast enough. The plane's going to sink like a stone. Increase power. Increase speed. Keep us airborne. How high are we? Where's the water? Nothing's working. We can't see anything. And another stall. And another stall. Over the minutes ahead, every new crisis triggering another surge of reaction inside the cockpit. No doubt the 61 passengers behind the cockpit doors well aware that something had gone terribly, unthinkably wrong. Chaos. I mean, everything just seemed upside down, backward, nonsensical. 25 minutes after the emergency was declared, the wingtip of this Boeing 757 struck something. It struck the water. Pull up, pull up, throttle up, recover, recover. We're on the deck. Jesus Christ, go up, up, pull up. Eternal seconds pass. As the pilots wrestle with the controls, flying blind in a machine that seemed intent on keeping them blind. And 17 seconds after grazing the water, Aero Peru Flight 603 entangled with the water and tumbled and shattered and splintered in the darkness. And most of the wreckage descended well below the surface. 70 people aboard, zero survivors. Unthinkable. Well, the debris still floating on top of the water was assembled. And Peruvian authorities teamed up with the United States and our Navy to help locate the wreckage that was under the water. What had happened to Flight 603? And the investigation examined the evidence and determined the cause of this terrible catastrophe. The cause was not a blown engine or a bird strike or hydraulic failure or bad weather or the act of a terrorist. The causes were a few small strips of duct tape. You see, the day before, a maintenance worker had been cleaning the airplane, and during the process of cleaning had placed duct tape over several of the static ports on the underside of the fuselage. The static ports are pressure-sensitive instruments that are used in aviation. They determine critical information and feed that info to the pilot and the co-pilot, airspeed, altitude, vertical speed, etc., right? They feed a critical conduit of information to the crew. And when these tiny pieces of duct tape were forgotten back in the hangar, left on the plane, left covering the static ports, just a couple pieces of duct tape, kind of tape we use around the house all the time for any number of purposes. You're going to patch this up. You're going to shore this up. You're going to seal this up. Just grab a little piece of duct tape and stick it right there. Forgotten on the airplane before it left for takeoff. It became inevitable the pilot and co-pilot would be receiving false information, conflicting information, nonsensical, confusing information about the status of their aircraft, and they wouldn't know it until they were already airborne. 70 lives lost, all because a few tiny pieces of tape were accidentally left in place over a few tiny portions of a 757, a very human oversight that might have happened to anyone, and that set in motion a chain of events that would transform a routine flight into an air disaster still remembered almost 20 years later. Had a message in from Marshall who said, "My butterfly effect story starts a few years ago. In high school, I was extremely depressed. For those of you who don't know what depression feels like, it's like a never-ending numbness. It's the inability to experience happiness or pleasure, and it can be absolutely crushing. After the third year of dealing with it, my junior year, I was considering suicide. My parents don't know this. They don't know I'd grabbed several pill bottles from the cabinet in the kitchen and that I was in my room with the lights turned off and wanting to just, you know, make it all stop. But at the same time, being so afraid. I wasn't leaving any note. I'd convinced myself no one would care. I truly believe nobody would. However, I did send a message to a Skype group chat, a small, close-knit group of about 6 people at the time, that I'd met a week before after one of them, who I'd known for about a month, invited me to join it. The message just said, "I'm going to be away for a while. If I don't respond to messages, don't worry, I'm fine." And the instant I clicked send, I got several messages back. "I hope you're doing okay. Be safe while you're gone. We'll miss you. We'll miss you." I cried. I cried until I'd forgotten about the pills until I ended up falling asleep at the keyboard. The next morning, I put the pills back up and I swore to myself I wouldn't ever think of something like that again, and so far I haven't. Since then, I've grown closer to that special little group. I'm even in an online relationship with one of them. He's been my boyfriend for a little over a year now. We're planning on finally seeing each other during Thanksgiving. Now I just have to explain to my parents that I'm in a homosexual relationship with someone 1,000 miles away, but I know I can do it now. So I started out, I was depressed, spent most of my time on the internet, I met a friend. We talked often and grew a bit closer. They led me to the group that inadvertently saved my life. And a man whom I have feelings for like I've never had for anyone else. They made me happy again, and they make me happy every day. Marshall, thanks so much for the message and for sharing your story. I've got David on Skype. David, you're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. How's it going?
G'day, Seth. It's great to be a part of your show. It's a great honor.
Taking me back to the month of March of this year, when Matt Dillahunty and Aaron Raw and I had the privilege of going to Australia. Hearing your accent reminds me of how much I miss it. It's just awesome.
Yeah, it was so wonderful that I remember listening to the Unholy Trinity shows last year on the podcast, and I was thinking back then, way back then, thinking, oh, gee, I'd love to get to one of these. And then you brought it all the way out to us, and it was great. It was great to see Joshua. It took you to some great places in Australia when you're here in Brisbane.
We're talking about the butterfly effect. What do you have for the broadcast today?
Yeah, well, the butterfly effect, tiny events that can change your life. For me, I think a washing machine breaking down at just the right time probably saved my life.
Tell me the story.
Well, back in 1972, I was about 6 months old, a little baby, and one evening my parents were driving home to our farm in outback Australia. They had just attended a big party in Moree, a small country town. And big events like this out in the bush, they're more than just an excuse for a few drinks. They're the social media of the day. They're an important way for young, isolated farming folks to get together a few times a year. As you discovered, Seth, Australia's as big as the USA, but it's very sparsely populated. So getting together is important when you live out in the bush. Anyway, before the party, they left me at my grandparents' house. And my grandparents had retired to a small house in town, and I was the first grandchild, so they loved having a baby boy there. They suggested to my dad, look, maybe let him stay the night. But trips to town on the rough gravel roads back then, they were not so common. We only had one car, and it was a long way. It was probably going to be another week before my mum would come back into town for supplies, so mum and dad still planned to pick me up after the party and take me home that night. Later in the evening, my grandmother's old washing machine broke down, and it was one of those old open-top machines with the ringer on the top. And when my parents came to collect me after the party, Dad decided after all, well, he might come back into town the next day, and he'll bring his tool set, and he'll fix the machine. And it was only because of this timing that they decided to leave me asleep in my cot, and they'd leave me there that night, and they'd collect me there the next day. So driving home, Mum and Dad, they were almost home after a long drive and probably less than a mile from the homestead, and a large kangaroo hops out from the scrub onto the road right in front of the car. Dad was really experienced at driving on country roads, but he swerved so hard to miss the kangaroo that it spun, and on the loose gravel, it flipped and it finished on its roof. And these are the days before seatbelts were all that common, so Dad initially feared Mum had she'd not survived. She was unconscious, she wasn't moving, and luckily she soon woke up and he helped her climb out from the upside down twisted metal and broken glass. And they slowly walked the remaining distance home, fortunately with no really serious injuries. So had that washing machine broken down at any other time, I would have been in the car with them and most likely on Mum's lap. These are the days before seatbelts and baby capsules, so we can never know, but it's unlikely I would have survived, considering how excited the car was the most damaged.
Because he had planned to go back the next day to fix the washing machine, he said, let's just leave David there. Let him stay the night. Don't disturb him. And that decision...
That's it. It was just that spur-of-the-moment decision. Yep. Mum would often remark that... Mum would often say years later that maybe there was some divine intervention in the timing of that broken washing machine. And I can't help but think that it would have been far simpler for an omnipotent being to make that kangaroo jump 2 seconds sooner or 2 seconds later and prevent the whole accident and maybe save a struggling farming family a written-off car in the process. But I guess he moves in mysterious ways, eh?
You know, it's funny you mentioned kangaroos. When we were down there, we went to, I forget the name of the zoo, the Steve Irwin Zoo, the one that's dedicated to him?
Australia Zoo. And I actually contacted, I don't know Joshua all that well, but I contacted him a few days before just to say I hope that your hosts are looking after you when you're here, and that's the best place to take any foreign tourists to Australia Zoo. It's just fantastic.
It was amazing. But they took us into this enclosed area filled with kangaroos, and of course it's an interactive area, so we were encouraged to go up and pet the kangaroos, and we're all taking photographs. And I was struck by two things. First of all, how easily we were able to access the kangaroos, how easily we just walked up to them. They didn't really move. They didn't really adjust. But the second thing I noticed is they all just look pissed off. You know, like, wait a minute. Well, how come we have people duty? How come we're stuck here inside the fences taking 1,000 selfies a day with everybody who's putting this shit on the internet? I'm tired of being petted. I'm tired of being touched. I'm tired of being bothered. I just want to sleep. All of them had that look on their face. It was hysterical.
Yeah, they are. I was there about 6 weeks ago. We used to have holiday passes for my kids and used to go regularly, and they've grown up a little bit now, but we did go back again a few weeks ago, and I thought of you when we were there, and I just thought of those kangaroos, and that is so not like kangaroos out in the wild where it is quite hard to get close to them. But yeah, you feel like they're just sitting around, lazing around, and you're just disturbing them. They're like, go away. I'm happy.
Go away. Stop touching me. Stop bothering me. I would like a human free zone is what all the kangaroos seem to be saying to us. But we did get some great photographs and some great memories out of it. Thanks, David, for sharing the story on the broadcast tonight. Great pleasure to have you, man.
Thank you, Seth. Wonderful to be a part of it.
Alicia sent in a message and said, I am an avid World of Warcraft player. And I have been for 8 years. I got a buddy who plays World of Warcraft. I haven't seen him for 8 years. I mean, that guy loves him some World of Warcraft. It's like a drug. Anyway, back to her letter. She said, I was in a small casual guild, but I had a few friends that were in raiding guilds. And forgive me, Alicia, for not understanding the difference. One of them asked me to heal a new member and real-life friend through some dungeons. I agreed, and I went about healing. That decision changed my life. The new person and I hit it off. He and I talked for hours. We hit it off right away. We talked in and out of World of Warcraft as well as on the phone. He is now, 6 years later, my husband. We married in 2011, but the simple choice to heal a dungeon has done more than simply introduce me to my husband. The relationship helped me to reconcile with my ex prior to his death, encouraged me to seek counseling for my severe clinical depression, and helped me move out of the rural town I've been stuck in by circumstance and go to the country I've always loved and adored, Canada. Thank you for your time, Alicia, a now very happy atheist. Thanks for sending the message. Alicia, greatly appreciated. Area code 540, you're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. Who's this?
This is Kayla.
Kayla, thanks for calling the broadcast. Let's talk about the butterfly effect. What do you have for us today?
Well, Seth, anytime that that this topic comes up, I think of a day way back in September of 2001 when I had a moment that was seemingly really not important at the time, and then later kind of became just one of those singular moments that really sticks out to me. And I was actually sitting in ninth grade world geography, and it was a brand new school, and I just moved there from a very small town, and I was having a little bit of trouble adjusting, and I was really lonely. And it was my last class of the day, and the girl in front of me actually turned around, and she looked at me, and she said, hey, did you do the homework? And me, I was the daughter of a teacher and a teacher who had become a soldier, and it was completely unthinkable to me that I would not do my homework. So I just said yes. And she said, can I see it? And I knew that it was cheating, but I said yes anyway. And today, she's still my best friend. And I didn't realize how long or how much that moment was going to affect me until a lot later. I was raised as an independent fundamentalist Baptist. And in the days prior to September 11th, 2001, the religion that everyone I had ever seen preached against was Catholicism. And again, I'd heard that Catholics weren't real Christians, that they worshipped idols, Mother Mary, and the saints. I learned that they were most likely going to hell. And one particularly inventive pastor that I knew actually believed that the Pope would be the head of the One World Church that would be formed by the Antichrist at the end of days. And we heard of what was wrong with so many other denominations too, Lutherans and Pentecostals and everybody, but
it's always fun to watch one denomination talk about how all of the other denominations or faiths are misguided, misled, or part of the end time scenario. It's just scary.
I know, right? It was really interesting to see, especially coming out of it now and just seeing kind of how everyone was wrong. But none of them really seemed to take the same heat that Catholicism did.
But your friend was Catholic, is that right?
She was. It was one day we were talking about church, actually, because, you know, I was a churchgoer. We were there every Sunday, twice a day at least, usually cleaned the church on Saturdays. We were there Wednesday nights, multiple times besides that, too, usually. And then I was telling her about my church stuff, and she said, I'm a Catholic. And I was like, what? How can she be a Catholic? She only has one head. I was pretty sure Catholics had two heads. And then, you know, I'm telling you. And the biggest thing was that she seemed as Christian as I did, you know? She didn't seem to have any weird beliefs or anything that seemed too out of the ordinary at first glance. And it could have just been because I was new at the school and she had, you know, come through the middle school that fed into the high school and she had lots of friends and she was, you know, integrating me into the school a little at a time. But all of a sudden, all the pastors that I had ever heard, I was wondering if they were right. And it was the first time that I can ever remember really questioning what I had heard from the pulpit. And that doubt never really went away. I was never really able to stop questioning what they said. And it was really the moment that there was no turning back from in a lot of ways, was meeting her that day, finding out she was Catholic, and realizing that maybe pastors didn't know everything. Maybe they were wrong sometimes.
It's amazing being able to see your friend in three dimensions, to be able to see the goodness inside of her and realizing that you had only seen Catholicism previously sort of in caricature. You'd been sold an idea of what Catholics are, what they're like. Mostly they're just people, right, living an inherited faith. Was your friend a devout Catholic?
She was not. They were very much, I guess, cultural Catholics, you would think. They went to Mass, you know, maybe once a month, definitely on the holidays. But other than that, you know, it really wasn't that different. So
now the chain of events kicks in where you're starting to become skeptical about all faiths. And what do you call yourself now?
I am an atheist, pretty firmly, actually. That was just, from that moment, I went on to question, you know, were they right about homosexuality? Were they right about evolution? Because that was something that we had entire series of pastors giving apologetics arguments so that we could counter evolution in our school classes. You know, this was an activity we did in our teen groups and things. And, you know, my pro-choice stance came from being able to question them on abortion and the morality of it and whether we should get involved in women's medical decisions and things like that. And just little by little, the ability to question that I learned from, you know, being shown that they were wrong about this one thing just led to questioning pretty much everything.
May I ask your friend's first name?
Jay.
If you hadn't bumped into Jay, if you guys hadn't shared homework all those years ago, it's likely you may not have ended up where you are today, huh?
It's very likely. I don't remember ever questioning before that. I just, even if I did question, I was able to squelch it, to push it down, and to tell myself that it was more important to be faithful than to question. When I was confronted with this person that, you know, I had truly started to like and to care about at that point, even though I didn't know how important she would be to me years and years later, it was difficult to accept that they were right about her. And it was difficult to believe, honestly, for me at the time, that someone so kind and so caring who had taken such good care of me when I was at a vulnerable point could be going to hell. That was a big point for me that led to a lot of discussions with my youth pastors, actually, over the years, and just not very many satisfactory answers.
I think that's in many ways why many fundamentalist homes discourage their children from interacting. It's not even, let's go out and be a shining light in a dark world, but they cordon them off. They build a wall around them. I think they're terrified that interacting with people of differing beliefs, different mindsets, different views will change the minds, the mindsets, the attitudes of their children. And so to reinforce that, they just sort of build a wall around them. I think this explains most religious homeschools, where they're genuinely terrified that you might see someone else in three dimensions, and really terrified you might actually like them and perhaps empathize and be curious about them, you know?
Definitely.
Kayla, you in a good place in your life today?
I am. I'm probably better than ever, honestly.
Good. Good for you. Well, thanks for sharing your butterfly effect story on the radio. That's good stuff. We're not endorsing the sharing of homework, people. All right. We're not saying you should cheat on the homework. We're saying this just kind of happened. All right. We'll leave it at that. And Catholics don't have two heads. We also have established that fact. Kayla, thanks for listening. Thanks for being a part of the broadcast.
Thank you, Seth.
Will sent a message and said, for me, it would probably be when my biology teacher told my class there was a debate between Bill Nye and Ken Ham on creation. And if we turned in a reaction, we could get extra credit. At the time, I was getting a D in his class, and I decided to take up his offer. My knowledge of Bill Nye was so little before the debate, I asked my friend if he was a creationist or an evolutionist. But I can honestly say that that debate is the reason I am now an atheist. If my biology teacher hadn't told us about it, I may still be a Christian. Will, I'm hungry for details in this story, man. Were you part of a Christian school environment? Was this guy wanting you to watch so that Ken Ham could help prove the Christian science textbooks, Christian versions of biology? Or were you a Christian in a public school environment? It seems an odd extra credit assignment for a teacher to give out. Hey, watch this debate between Bill Nye and Ken Ham. We did a whole show on whether or not that debate should have happened, you know, especially on the grounds of the Creation Museum. But more and more, as I see the aftermath, I think Bill Nye represented quite well. And I honestly think science truly benefited from having Bill at the forefront in that discussion. I mean, Ken Ham can claim victory all he wants, but if you look at the arguments presented side by side, Ken Ham never got past the Bible says so, and were you there? That's all he had. And check out our PhDs. That was another tactic that he used. But outside of that, Bill Nye brought the science. And I honestly see that encounter as a positive one. I'm glad it happened. If they do it again, I would like to see it held on more neutral ground, and I'd like to make sure that Ken Ham doesn't have the opportunity to benefit financially from hosting it. But yeah, you know, I'd welcome another matchup. Scott said this, the day was December 2nd, 1988. It was Friday night. I was a 10-year-old kid at my little brother's birthday party. Post-party, when no adults were watching us, I took it upon myself to improve one of his presents, a little toy truck with a cannon mounted on the trailer. My brother was shooting these dart-shaped projectiles at a bunch of party balloons clumped together in the corner. The small spring-loaded cannon did not have enough force to pop the balloons, but my brother kept trying anyway. Thinking I was being clever, I fastened an open paper clip to the end of one of the darts. Success! My brother gleefully went on popping the balloons. A short time later, when the balloons were exhausted and my brother was happily carrying his new modified weapon around the house, the most predictable thing happened. It accidentally discharged. At the exact moment the cannon went off, I turned the corner to enter the room. In the most unlucky and ironic moment of my life, the opened paper clip that I had fastened to the dart earlier struck me in the left eye. It was a freak accident, just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. What are the odds the path of the dart would be such to hit me in the eye as I was moving? Pretty low, right? That one moment changed the trajectory of my life. My parents didn't believe me when I told them my eye wouldn't stop hurting. They sent me to bed. I cried throughout the night. The next day, the lens in my left eye had to be surgically removed. and the focusing muscles were permanently damaged. That day was the only time I can remember seeing my father cry. My ocular history is only relevant in that without my natural lens, I required a contact lens to see out of my left eye. If I failed to put the lens in, I would have a lazy eye within hours. As if adolescence wasn't hard enough on its own, I was brutally thrust from a childhood ignorance into the reality of living with a minor disability. I became the target of bullying at school. Every person I turned to for help couldn't protect me, my parents, teachers, God. No one could stop other kids from laughing at me for looking different, or because I missed every swing at batting practice. This went on for most of my childhood. I came to loathe going to school every morning. I'd pray at night for a snowstorm to close school. It was at this time I began to question the efficacy of prayer and the rules for getting into heaven. My grandmother gave me a St. Lucy medallion because she was the patron saint of blind people. Wait a minute, there's a St. Lucy? It just sounds like such a contemporary name for a saint. Back to the email. More importantly, my grandmother didn't just pray for me, she subscribed to medical journals. When I was 16, we were lucky enough to find an eye surgeon who wanted to perform an artificial lens implant. This type of procedure wasn't commonly done on teenagers, and insurance wouldn't cover it. But my family figured out a way to make it happen. My grandmother always gives God and her praying credit for finding the right surgeon with a charitable attitude. I always give credit to my family's persistence and love, and to science, all caps, science. To their credit, my family wouldn't let me quit. They made me go to school, they made me play sports, even though I was never going to be good at them. In some ways, they were overbearing and protective, but in other ways, more accepting. One of the earliest nuggets of wisdom my father passed on to me was this, quote, "Even if it's not okay, it's okay." He held to his own advice. When I told my family I didn't believe anymore, instead of trying to reinforce indoctrination techniques, they accepted me and let me find my own worldview. My left eye has pretty decent vision today. I emerged from that part of my life not just a physically changed person, treated as an outcast for being different and finding no respite in religion, helped me literally outgrow Catholicism at a young age. Loving to play sports but never getting physically better at them led my interest to science and math. I left my faith behind in the gentle and progressive manner that children outgrow Santa Claus. After graduating high school, I left my small town to study engineering at a big school. I became fascinated by computers and this new thing called the Internet. I grew up to be open-minded to new ideas and tolerant of things that are different. But more importantly, I finally come around on liking Christmas stories, quote, "You'll shoot your eye out, and it's all fun and games until someone loses an eye," jokes. I think that all I am today can be traced back to that one defining moment. Keep up the great work with the show, Scott. Scott, thanks for sharing, man. Appreciate it. I've got Judy on Skype. Judy, you're on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast. How's it going?
Well, it's going fine.
Well, let's talk about the butterfly effect in the context of small things making a big difference. You got a story?
Oh, I have a good story. I used to be a school teacher, and I taught eighth grade and I taught high school. A student sought me out years after. I was even at a different school, but she found me because she wanted to thank me. Apparently, there's something I did that I didn't realize at the time was going to impact anybody's life. But it's definitely a butterfly effect. Oh, my gosh. It changed her entire life, she told me. And she had to find me and tell me this. In the eighth grade, I was teaching math, and she was sitting back. It was about 5 minutes before the bell was going to ring. And the lesson was over, and I was letting students come up and kind of mill around and ask me questions about the homework and so forth. There were maybe four or five students up at the front of the room. And I wanted to get to all of the students before the bell rang. And so I saw this girl at her desk, packing up her stuff, her books, putting everything together. And she got out what looked like a pink hall pass, you know, so that she could leave early. And she came up and she was holding the pink hall pass out toward me for me to check. You're supposed to check for signature and so forth. And I didn't want to disrupt the students who were asking questions. So I just kind of waved her off and kind of indicated, go toward the door. You're fine. Just leave. And she stood there. She kept holding out the pink hall pass and she said, don't you want to check it? And I said, no, you know where you're going. And so she left the room, and that's the end of anything I knew. But she told me these years later that she had a profound experience walking down the hallway that changed her entire life. And she told me that she ended up changing all of her friends. That's massive. This was in eighth grade. She ended up deciding that she should take studying seriously, and she didn't just try to turn in papers. Now she was going to learn the material. She changed her whole life. She decided on new goals, a whole new direction. It was amazing. And I said, well, I couldn't figure it out. What was it that happened? And I'll never forget this line. She said, you said I knew where I was going. I figured if you thought I knew where I was going, then I should too.
Judy, did that really happen?
Yes.
She was going to give you the pass. She said, nah, you got this.
Well, she was already one of those really nice students, and that's why she stood there wanting to give me the pass, even though I waved her off, because she was trying to do it the right way. She wanted me to check the pass. But, you know your students, and I knew she was one of the really nice ones who would not try to pull something over on me. She told me later that she had a dentist appointment. Her parents were supposed to pick her up. And it was very easy for me just to say, no, go ahead. You know where you're going. And it was that phrasing, apparently, that really hit her hard. I have a lot of stories. Teachers probably all have wonderful stories of how students find them later and they say things. But that one was just amazing because it was an offhand remark that I said just to save myself time, really.
Yeah. And so your declaration of confidence in her essentially gave her confidence in herself.
That's amazing. And I find that when I see role models, I see people who have impacted my life immensely, and they weren't doing anything out of the ordinary. But to me, I saw that and I went, wow, you never know when someone else is doing something that's going to impact your life, too.
How many years after the fact did she make contact?
Well, let's see. It was eighth grade and she was an adult. She was like maybe 23. So
she'd probably been waiting for the opportunity to cross paths again with you and share the story, huh?
Well, maybe. I mean, she didn't find me the next year or the next year or the next year, but maybe as time goes on, maybe she just realized, oh my gosh, I want to go find that teacher now. And that happens once in a while. I've had other students too who seek me out. I'm at a different school now, but they find me. And, it's heartwarming to hear those things and heartwarming for us to go back to school and find our teachers too.
That's cool, Judy. Well, thanks for sharing your story on the radio. Good stuff.
Yeah, you bet, Seth. Thanks for what you do.
Area code 831. You're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. Who's this?
This is Catherine.
Catherine, we're talking about the butterfly effect. What do you have for the show today?
I wanted to call and share about the story of how my husband and I met. About 8 years ago, I'd just gotten out of Navy boot camp, and I got to my first A school. And a friend of mine who showed up in the same group I was in, we were planning on going down to a local farmer's market. And she asked if this guy that she'd been trying to meet up with all week could tag along with us because they kept missing each other. I said I didn't really care. I'd never met him before, but I didn't mind if he came along with us. He and I ended up really hitting it off, and we celebrated 7 years of marriage last February, and our daughter just turned 2 in July.
So if you hadn't gone to the farmer's market so many years ago.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever would have met up with him or connected with him, and my whole life could have been different. I can't imagine my life now without him in it or my daughter.
Well, congratulations to you guys. That's cool. So just one invitation made all the difference. Hey, come hang with us for an afternoon. It'll be great. And before you know it, you're life partners.
Oh, completely. It made a huge difference in my life. We actually sat down a few years later and just out of curiosity, we wanted to see what other little things led to that moment of us meeting. And it started back when he first decided to enlist, and he was at the military entrance processing station. And his sister had lent him a copy of Dead Like Me to watch. And the friend that introduced us had saw him watching it. And they started talking about it. They decided to meet up. when they got to the training command, he actually convinced her to switch from enlisting in the Air Force over to the Navy. And because she switched over to the Navy, she and I were in the same group at the same time when we arrived, and all of that led up to the moment that he tagged along, and the rest is history.
All of these tiny gears in the machine, right? You have no idea how it's going to affect the other way down the road. Are you still in the military, or did you move on?
I actually got out the year before my daughter was born, and he's still in. He's actually deployed right now.
For how long?
6 months this time.
That's got to be tough. You know, he's overseas, I'm guessing, or what?
Yeah, he's over in Japan.
All right. Well, I mean, let's just say he happened upon the show link and was listening to the broadcast from Japan. You want to just say hi or something?
Yeah, I'd love to say hi, Jay. I love you. We are so proud of what you're doing over there, and we can't wait for you to come home.
Catherine, you're awesome. Thanks for being a part of the broadcast, okay?
Thank you.
And Jay, you be safe over there, and we'll see you back here at home in 6 months minus a week, okay? The writer of my next email is also military, Air Force in this case. He said this: the person I am today, the job I have, the family I love, and even my non-belief can all be the result of one phone call on a lazy Saturday morning in 1986. I grew up in a small town in southern New Hampshire. My mom was divorced twice, and even though I had older brothers, they were out of the house, and I was essentially an only child. Mom did what she could as a single parent to make ends meet. She worked all day and also tended bar at night. This left me on my own for the most part, with little or no parenting or supervision. I was barely making passing grades in school and had just lost my part-time job delivering pizza. I really had no plan or outlook for my future. But then something happened that would give me the opportunity to change my future, even though I didn't know it at the time. It was my senior year of high school in early spring. A Saturday like many other, I had no real plans that I can remember. I was supposed to go job hunting, but I talked myself out of that. I thought, nobody hires on the weekend. I'll make sure I go look on Monday. I was eating blueberry cereal that I'd squirreled away from last Halloween and watching Land of the Lost on our console TV when the phone rang. By the way, you just gave away your age. Loved me some Land of the Lost when I was growing up. I answered the phone expecting it to be my mom telling me to get my ass out of the house and go look for a job. But instead it was Mike, one of my friends from school. He asked if I was doing anything at the moment, and I said, of course I was. I was very busy. And he said I was full of crap and I should go with him and Scott, another one of my friends, to the U.S. Air Force recruiter station in Portsmouth. After a long pause, I asked him, why the hell would I want to do that? Well, he explained they were going to take the pre-entry exam for the Air Force. Mike and Scott were both in ROTC. They planned on following in their family tradition of being in the military. I still was not impressed. But they said, look, if I took the test with them, I would get free lunch. Then, after, we could all go downtown, maybe check out one of the new underage clubs that had just opened. Well, he had me at free lunch, so I was on my way. Hell, I had nothing else to do except for look for another meaningless job, so I went with him, I breezed through the test, and I spent the rest of the day trying to talk to girls way out of my league. The end. Or so I thought. Fast forward 2 years. My life was not looking great. I'd lost my job again. I couldn't make the rent on the apartment I was sharing. I was getting kicked out. My car was on its last few cylinders. I needed to do something. Then I remembered the test. The test. I ended up doing pretty well on it, but I wondered if it was still valid. I called the recruiter. 60 days later, I was reciting the oath of enlistment and off to basic training at Lackland Air Force Base, Texas. Leaving home was the best thing I could have done. When your perspective changes, you start to see things differently. The first thing I realized was that I wanted to be with my girlfriend. Being apart from Lisa hurt. If I hadn't left, I might not have stepped up so quickly. We got married, my first year of active duty, and this year marks our 29th anniversary. Along the way, we had two beautiful daughters who've grown up to be beautiful women I'm very proud of. I got to travel all over the world and experience other cultures and people. It wasn't just backwoods New England for me anymore. The people I served with and met along the way brought so many different ideas to the table, ideas I would have never been exposed to back home. The Air Force also made me value an education. I had a career now, and not only was I encouraged to go to college, it was free. I took classes when I could during my 20 years and retired with a degree in computer science. That's also something I would have never been able to do if I'd stayed home. Throughout this whole time, the travel, the education, there was a nagging, persistent question of religion and God. Wherever I traveled, there was always some version of it, but they were all different. They couldn't all be correct, could they? Even growing up, I never really completely bought it, and these new experiences opened my eyes. I made it a little hobby of mine and did some research. I even took some college courses on my own. Then, after my research and several discussions with religious friends, I came to the conclusion it was all bullshit. I was an atheist. So much time wasted finding the truth, but I wouldn't have even started to search if I had stayed home. So here I am. I'm now one of the top in my field in a career I enjoy. I've got a loving family I cherish. I'm firmly grounded in truth and directing that focus to become more of an activist for secular humanism. The future is bright. And I owe all of this to one phone call on a lazy Saturday morning 30 years ago. How cool is that? The email is unsigned, but thank you so much for sending it and sharing your story for the broadcast today. Much appreciated. You know, it's funny, when I was a believer, I would have chalked all this up to divine destiny. The great interventionist up there in the sky would have been arranging things so that I would have been at the certain place at a certain time. I would have sat in a certain seat next to a certain person and had an encounter with someone who would change everything. I would have walked in the building at this exact moment. I would have turned this corner. I would have done this thing, taken this trip. I would have had this moment in my life set up in advance by the divine architect above, right? We believed in divine destiny. It's all part of God's master plan. And of course, now, as a non-believer in deities, I don't believe in divine destiny. I don't believe in fate, quote-unquote fate. I see us as physical bodies operating in a physical universe, acting and reacting. But I find it fascinating to be able to see how these tiny moments in our lives, the supposedly meaningless moments, the stuff that didn't really matter, actually did matter in a big way. And in many cases, changed the trajectory of people's lives. I was shocked at how many people had falling in love stories. I had way more than I could ever share on the radio tonight. I mean, tons of people talking about how they bumped into their future life partners and spouses, and they've been together for freaking ever. If they hadn't done this or been here or met this person or done this thing, it would have never happened. Who knows where they'd be? That kind of stuff fascinates me. Hell, I got a story like that myself. Played tennis at a facility that's about 5 miles down the road years ago. They knew I would play anywhere, anybody, anytime. I just wanted court time. So they would always call me when people didn't show up. And this happens from time to time. You schedule a doubles match and somebody just doesn't show. They don't get the message. They forget. And so there's a hole in the lineup, and they call somebody like me. They go, "Hey, Seth, we need somebody. Can you come out and play?" "Okay, no problem. I'll be right there." So I end up as the fourth person in a doubles lineup on court 5, and the person I played doubles with on that evening, years ago, was Natalie. We got married on August 1st of last year. Now, if I hadn't been called to fill in that night, chances are we would have never met. There's hundreds of people who play out there. We might have met, but in a different capacity. We'd have never really had a chance to even say hi. Our lives might be totally different today. That kind of stuff does fascinate me. Many of the stories we got in were from people who said, "Oh, I bumped into someone and we fell in love, and then they ruined my life." I had several of those come in, and they were dark stories. So dark, in fact, that I elected not to use them for the show. just too much abuse, too dark, too many gory details in there that I just didn't feel that I wanted to use them for this particular show. But they do provide examples of the fact that, yeah, you know, not every encounter is a positive one. Many of them change your life for the worse. They're negative encounters. You don't even realize it at the time, but it would have been better if you hadn't ever bumped in to this person. Yeah, those stories do exist. But I hope that this sort of casual exploration of some random stories of people just like us acting and reacting in the real world has been an entertaining broadcast for you. Thanks so much for listening to it. I have something coming up next week I'm excited about. I'm going to be talking to a woman named Greta Vosper. She's a reverend for the United Church of Canada. She's a reverend at West Hill Church. Under the Methodist banner, she is an atheist. She does not believe in a literal God. She was ordained in 1993. She joined her church in 97. She's been behind the pulpit for freaking ever. But lately, her atheism has come to light, and it looks like the United Church of Canada is working to force her out of the pulpit. Well, I'm curious about this woman and her story. How does an atheist lock into a Methodist ministry? What's the congregation have to say about all of this? Do you want to stay in a church that may not want you? And what's going to happen next? Well, Greta Vosper is going to join me on the radio to talk about who she is, why she is, and what's happening up there in Canada. So stay tuned for that one coming up in just a few days. Thank you again for listening to the show. Our broadcast brought to you by Harry's Razors. It's a better shave value and starter sets at only $15 with $5 off your very first purchase. All you have to do is go to harrys.com and lock in that coupon code THINKINGATHEIST. That's HARRYS.com. And I'll see you next week.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.